Well, it's my pleasure to introduce the Religion and English Literature section today. I think we have two very fine papers, one by Professor Waller, Imagination and Ideology, The Literary Autonomy of the Countess of Pembroke Psalms, and one by Professor Jones, The Diversity Between Mercy and Vain Pity in Measure for Measure. Professor Waller is an assistant professor at the English Department of Dalhousie University. Originally a native of New Zealand, he took his PhD at Cambridge. He's published a number of articles on Shakespeare and other Elizabethan topics. He's recently completed a book on Shakespeare and other Renaissance writers called The Strong Necessity of Time. He published in 1974. He's presently engaged in research on various aspects of the Countess of Pembroke and is presently editing her writings for Oxford University Press. Professor Waller?
One of the coincidental nice things about this conference has proved to be that I'm giving this paper on the Countess of Pembroke's 412th birthday. Shortly after her brother's death in 1586, Mary Sidney, Countess of Pembroke, took up his unfinished metaphrase of the Psalms. Over the next 15 years, she revised his 43 Psalms and completed the remaining 107 herself, sometimes making two or three quite independent versions, a total of 162 altogether. The Sidney's versions of the Psalms are arguably the finest English versifications. They bring the flexibility and the rich suggestiveness of the high Elizabethan lyric into the Reformation fashion for psalm metaphrase, creating at their best, in the Countess's versions of 51 or 90, for instance, quite remarkable meditative poems in their own right. As well, the Psalms display an imaginative autonomy that frequently takes them beyond the status of mere translation, incorporating much of the intellectual richness of the Sidney Circle's diverse interests. The Sidneys were generally aware of current developments in biblical understanding, and they were familiar with many of the popular commentaries on the Psalms. But their understanding of the Psalms generally differs significantly from that of a commentator or a scholar. The Countess especially displays an habitual independence of understanding and evocation. In many cases, her versions are not intended as translations accurate to the point of sacrificing atmosphere to literal particularity. They are, that is, united not by a desire to spell out the doctrinal coherence of the Psalms, but rather by a fertile and maturing poetical imagination. And their consistency is that of a desire to penetrate to the roots of the experience as evoked in the originals. Although the results vary in quality, the Countess's approach to her text is usually as communicated experience, not as encapsulated doctrine. In pursuing this aim, she brings into play an intellectual tension that is central to the whole Sidneyan ethos, what I have elsewhere called, in the words of Kelvin, a matching of contraries between the theological drives of her Protestant piety and attitudes derived from courtly Neoplatonist, even magical philosophies, which have their roots in principles ultimately hostile to Reformed theology, but which were nevertheless held together in the shimmering dialectic of the Sidney Circle. Paradoxically, more than any other English translator or scholar, she gets closer to the variety of religious experience actually present in the originals. Perhaps unintentionally, the experiential contraries of her psalms cut through the Reformation's repeated assertions of their doctrinal unity. By concentrating on their evocation of religious emotion, the Countess sensed the extraordinary diversity of the Psalter, a diversity that was matched and reinforced by the interest of the Sidney Circle itself. The interest and importance of these psalms is, of course, gradually becoming recognized by modern scholars. Few, however, have realized the untapped riches in the 16 manuscripts now known, manuscripts which exist in a very clear relationship that has important implications for the nature of the translation. By studying the manuscripts, it can be seen that the Countess is, in effect, schooling herself in poetical composition, as she first revised her brother's versions, then experimented with what became a unique variety of metrical and stanzaic patterns. She worked with two separate texts, at Wilton and London, and often devised quite independent versions of particular psalms. Then, as manuscript copies were circulated, She frequently wrote further versions, a process which in itself calls into question the term translation. Thus, for instance, there are two parallel versions of Psalms 69, 89, and 113. Psalm 122 has three quite separate ones. Formally, therefore, a study of the manuscripts shows how she is bringing to both the metaphrase tradition and the Elizabethan religious lyric a structural inventiveness and variety that demonstrates her considerable and maturing skills as a poet. It is, of course, as Sidney remarked, not mere versifying that makes a poet, and to watch through the manuscripts the Countess discovering her talents as a poet is a fascinating process. When the Psalms are set alongside other contemporary translations and commentaries, there is again the frequent sense of reaching for the underlying religious experience of the original. Like her brother, she wrote with a number of other translations beside her, usually giving doctrinal precedence to the Geneva Bible. There are therefore many Psalms where the interpretation, predictably enough from a lady of stern piety, is clearly the product of Orthodox Reformed theology. Occasionally she will pick up a hint from, say, the gloss of the Geneva version, or from perhaps Beza, to stress imputed rather than inherent righteousness. But normally she will reach for what she senses as the experience behind the doctrine, and the ringing conclusion to Psalm 58, which you have there, is an instance of this. Here we have a far more effective grasp of tone, with its threatening formal vindictiveness, than in any other contemporary version. The difference is that the Countess is concerned with evoking the religious energies that lie behind what Protestant commentators understood as doctrine. Another instance where the Countess is able to release the feelings that lie behind theological commonplace is her stress upon God's actively hardening the hearts of the reprobate in Psalm 53, where she builds up an impressive culmination, asserting one of the great Calvinist sureties that echo through the literature of denunciation in the 16th century. Other examples could be provided. The doctrinal stiffening at the start of Psalm 76, again, a matter of feeling for the tone, or the different kind of example at Psalm 62, verse 11, a verse which was the subject of some doctrinal controversy. Here, putting the Psalms alongside the commentators, one senses the Countess brooding over the different commentators, giving a passing nod to Beza, pausing longer over Calvin, and preferring for once to follow Coverdale rather than Geneva. These are brief and very random examples of some of the ways the Countess is concerned with finding not just the best translation to follow, but the most moving poetical evocation of religious experience. The randomness, I should say, points up the crucial nature of her Psalms, that she realized the variety of experience depicted within what was by so many commentators welded into a doctrinal unity. Another particularly interesting example, indicating not merely a judicious selection among commentators, but a marked degree of meditational independence, is found at Psalm 103, verse 14. The image of God as a potter and man as his clay, which you see in that quotation, is, of course, derived most explicitly from Romans 9, and it is a favorite Protestant commonplace. But neither Geneva nor any commentator brings out the prophetic possibilities of the psalmist image as clearly as Mary Sidney does. As a poet, she is free to range in the zodiac of her own wit, and is, if I may adapt Sidney's words, not captive to the truth of the brazen word. In evoking the doctrinal implications of the image, she is not only going back to the root meaning of the Hebrew, but she is imaginatively enriching her version by bringing in a New Testament reference to which the psalm obviously pointed forward. She is meditating on the text before her, and her poetic force derives from this sense of personal involvement. So far, I'm suggesting that in the process of discovering the religious experience expressed by the psalms, she may frequently reinforce their rhetorical impact by a fine grasp of tone, and how also, Calvin or Beza's commentaries and sometimes various marginal glosses in the Geneva version might suggest to her points of emphasis or development. In such examples, imaginative realization is perfectly consistent with her own doctrinal allegiances. But there's another level of imaginative recreation where something different is happening. There is evidence in both the Countess's and her brother's psalms for the presence of intellectual emphases contrary to their strong Reformed piety. In what Louis Marz calls the Sydney's attempt to bring the art of the Elizabethan lyric into the service of psalmody, they imported not only the rhetorical vigour and flexibility of the court lyric, but also some of the sophisticated courtly philosophy that the secular lyric so often served to express. The Countess's expansion of Psalm 104:19 is an obvious example of the way the lyrical riches of the golden Elizabethan lyric are brought into her verse, the elaboration coming straight from the conventional figures of Elizabethan amplification. A more ideologically profound example is the opening of Psalm 81. Geneva's marginal gloss describes the psalm as a solemn composition for the feasts and assemblies of the people, to whom for a time these ceremonies were ordained, but now under the gospel are abolished. And the same firm distrust of frivolity and ceremony is found in Calvin and Beza. God, says Calvin, is not to be worshipped with idleness, and Beza emphasizes that godly celebration must be void of all wantonness, so that your joy may tend to the glory of God. The Countess, however, strikes immediately in her translation a joyful, musical, and even a frivolous note. I'll just read this, because it is in the tone rather than in the word that the meaning comes across. All gladness gladdest hearts can hold, in merriest notes that mirth can yield. Let joyful songs to God unfold, to Jacob's God our sword and shield. Muster hither music's joys, lute and lyre and tabret's noise. Let no instrument be wanting, chasing grief and pleasure planting. The emphasis here and throughout the next part of the psalm is on a wholehearted celebration with a rich assemblage of music and colour and spectacle. Once again, we see the Countess meditating on the tone of the psalm, her poem taking on an independent life beyond the stern boundaries of theology. Castiglione, we might say, has triumphed over Calvin. The Countess's delight in courtly ornamentation is also illustrated by her interesting elaboration of Psalm 45, verses 13 to 14. Here again, the lines are alive with the swirl of robes, the celebration of what might pass for a courtly marriage between a costly bedecked Elizabethan lady and the ideal uomo universale of the Renaissance. Psalm 45, of course, was crucial in the Reformation's understanding of the Messianic King. It praises Solomon and then turns to admonish the bride on her place and duties. But as Calvin put it, under this image, the majesty, wealthiness, and far spreading abroad of Christ's kingdom are adorned with their titles. In tone, the psalm can be read as a celebration of the nobility, even the divine potential of man, and it's instructive to note that it caused Reformed commentators some difficulty. Beza, interestingly, asserts that the whole psalm is altogether allegorical, and he devotes 8 earnest pages in his commentary to unravelling its significance for the duties and rights of kings. Calvin is worried about the misapplication of such costly finery to church decoration and the sober service of God. He glosses it, predictably enough, as an allegory of the church, a reading which is not denied by Mary Sidney's version, but which is, on the most direct level, startlingly at odds with the psalm's tone of sensual celebration. Rather than being bogged down by doctrinal constraints, she is going back to the original and setting it in an evocative Elizabethan context. Her poem becomes an imitation rather than a translation. There are, in fact, 2 overlapping processes I'm trying to isolate here. One is an imaginative autonomy, which at their best liberates the Countess's psalms from the bounds of mere translation. The other, a process of intellectual independence, as she takes a hint from a gloss or commentator, or independently gives her psalm a particular ideological twist. On the first process, Rosamund Tove's well-known essay on Herbert's The Sacrifice is relevant. She showed that the basic invention or structural situation of Herbert's poem, the sequence of ironies upon which it is built, the occurrence, setting, and application of the refrain which binds it together, the very collocation of the antitheses which make it up, are none of them Herbert's. What difference, then, is there between approaching Herbert's Sacrifice and one of the Countess's psalms? The originality of Herbert's poem lies in the unifying voice, the careful modulation of response, and not in the highly traditional structure or arrangement. The basic difference is perhaps that the Countess's sources are more specifically definable. She is imitating a psalm. just as Robert Lowell's imitations have definable primary sources, to take a modern instance. As Lowell himself puts it, "I have been reckless with literal meaning and laboured hard to get the tone. Most often this has been a tone, for the tone is something that will always escape transference to another language and cultural moment." How far does such a view of imitation apply to the Sidneian Psalms? With the exception of the acrostic Psalms 111 and 117, where the Countess's version is recognisably Elizabethan in tone and form, and where the original is kept only generally in mind, she is never reckless with the literal meaning. But she is constantly trying for the appropriate tone by reaching for an Elizabethan mode rather than trying to recreate the Hebrew. The relationship between text and imitation in her Psalms ranges from careful translation on the one hand to poems where the original is only a general starting point. Many of the longer narrative or historical Psalms frequently degenerate into formally competent but mechanical translation. It is usually the shorter, emotionally direct lyrics to which the Countess brings the greatest imaginative autonomy. She is at her most confident when dealing with strong subjective emotions like anguish or joy, or when she finds the great commonplaces of Elizabethan cosmology or rhetorical amplification adaptable to her original. Psalm 80, verses 8 to 11, for instance, encourages her to develop the original imagery of planting and growth, and to emphasize further the typological significance of the original, which of course refers back to such passages as in Genesis 49 and forward to Isaiah 5 and 27. In her original amplifications, she has an especial preference for the ironical, the paradoxical, and often her rhetoric resembles Greville's or Raleigh's in its terseness of tone. In others, it can be elaborate and rich. To Psalm 148, verses 8 to 12, she weds a picture typical of the most serene Elizabethan cosmology, of the universe moving mysteriously at God's command in a complex, courtly dance. Other instances could be given, the joyful pattern movement of Psalm 72, the lilting Psalm 134, which do not capture the tone of the original so much as a mood appropriate and integral to the poem. Like a brother, it seems that the Countess was attracted by the courtly celebratory strain as well, which is evident in many of the Psalms. And here I return to the second process, the intellectual independence that I see operating in the Psalms. Courtly joy and celebration lent itself readily to being expressed in the fashionable guise of late Renaissance courtly Neoplatonism. I've briefly discussed so far some of the Countess's courtly Psalms, where it is most evident and most at odds with the Protestant allegiances of the Sidneys. But where it is most clearly seen, interestingly enough, is in fact in Sidney's version of Psalm 8, verses 4 to 6, a translation that the Countess left strictly alone in her various and detailed revisions of his text. Like Psalm 45, this apparent paean to man's status in Psalm 8 gives Protestant commentators a great deal of trouble. Of the commentators that the Sidneys used, Beza describes it as a thanksgiving to God for man's creation in Adam and redemption in Christ, and stresses that it underlines how man by his own fault did fall from his first high dignity. But a reading that one can find in among contemporary commentators speaks of something different, speaks of something more than man's fallen state on these verses. There is often a parallel drawn here with Psalm 144, verse 3, which is verbally similar in some respects, and it certainly lends itself to a reading like this, and both the Geneva gloss and the commentators make much of its assertion of man's depravity. But Psalm 8, verses 4 to 6 is another matter. The particular one commentator I have in mind does in fact remark that the lines are a tribute to the excellence of man's dignity, showing how he is uniquely created to ponder the plan of the universe. And this commentator then immediately quotes, having remarked that, from the Hermetic writings on the wonder and power of man, claiming, he says, that man was once and can again become a divine being. The commentator is, of course, Pico della Mirandola, and the psalm is used by him as the starting point for his glorification of man's infinite powers of self-transformation. From Calvin to Pico encompasses a wide spectrum of Renaissance thought on the nature of man, and the stress on man's autonomy which underlies Pico's oration is certainly faithful to the tone of a possible reading of Psalm 8, and yet it is one that is obviously antipathetic to a Calvinist reading. The Geneva gloss rather uneasily remarks on these verses that God had no need to thus come so low as to man which is but dust, and it reassures its readers that the psalm's stress on man's crowning is touching only his first creation. Calvin, when he comments on these verses, is in even more difficulty. He plainly disapproves of the psalm's rhetorical extravagance. God, he comments on verse 3, has no great need of great rhetoricians, but merely of distinct speech. He then argues that the psalm, in fact, stresses the miseries of man, this, he says, miserable and vile creature, and he comments disapprovingly, "It is a wonder that the Creator of heaven submitted himself so low as to vouchsafe to take upon him the care of mankind." Such a conjunction of divinity and depravity obviously worries him. And here the affinities between Calvin and Renaissance Neoplatonism, perceived some years ago by Roy Battenhouse, is certainly not evident, where what Calvin sees as a Neo-Pelagian misreading of the psalm is a distinct possibility. The Sidney's version certainly has the appropriate wonder that man should be elevated by God. But again, it is the tone that conveys the ideological drive. There's an almost Hellenistic note of glorification that comes straight out of the sophisticated courtesy of the Elizabethan aristocrat. He turns the psalmist's wonder at the privileges of man into a celebration of man's possibilities. Man is attended by God, an owner of regal status and crowning honor. There's no sense of imputed glory, no acknowledgement of man's depravity. Man emerges as a free and wondrous being, as capable on his own level as his creator of freely ranging within the zodiac of his own wit. Courtly philosophy, in other words, here is suggestively emerging as the celebration of man's creative autonomy, and in the psalm balances the Calvinist view of man as a sinful and limited being. Uniquely, the contraries coexist. Now, in what can only be a sketch of part of a long overdue revaluation of the Sidney Psalms, and most especially the Countess's contribution to them, I'm suggesting, therefore, that they not only contain poetry which bears comparison with the finest religious verse of the age, but as well they provide a reflection of the whole ideological ethos of the Sidney Circle. The Countess of Pembroke, in revising her brothers and writing her own psalms, draws out from her originals conflicting, even contradictory attitudes to man's nature and place in the universe. And not only are her poems worth reading in their own right, as she struggles movingly to an impressive display of imaginative autonomy, but we are given a fascinating insight into an important aspect of the late Elizabethan mind, where poetry and theology nourished each other, and where ideas that might be ideological contraries are transformed in the crucible of the poetical imagination. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Professor Jones, who will speak next, is an associate professor at the English Department of Northeast Missouri State University, where she has worked with Robert Snucker in his interdisciplinary seminars there. The paper that she will present today is a brief section from her very interesting dissertation done at the University of Alabama on the diversity of mercy and vain pity in three Shakespearean plays, Two Gentlemen of Verona, Measure for Measure, and The Tempest. She adds that she writes a little verse and that she enjoys nonsense. Professor Jones.
The play that we'll deal with this afternoon is Measure for Measure. Measure for Measure is a story of love mercy, and law. After 19 years of ruling without a strict adherence to the letter of the law, the Duke of Vienna has decided that his subjects have misconstrued his mercy as permission to break the law without fear of penalty. He believes that the city needs a stricter judge to reestablish lawful conduct, but he also believes that he himself has little moral justification for punishing his people for what he has in effect invited them to do. It would be tyrannous for him suddenly to become severe, but necessary and just for his deputy to be so. Therefore, he appoints Angelo, a man of virtuous reputation, to assume his authority, then pretends to leave the city. In disguise as a friar, he observes both the deputy and those who fall victim to the new enforcement of the law. These include Claudio, the fornicator, and Pompey, the bawd. When the deputy proves to be corrupt, the Duke intrigues to expose that corruption until, in a final spectacle of judgment, he resumes the role of merciful ruler, offering pardon to both the deputy and those whom the deputy has prosecuted. The merciful ruler's impulse to forgive must overcome a tendency established early in this play to identify all kinds of forgiveness as a kind of vain pity. Sir Thomas Eliot describes vain pity in a chapter of the book named The Governor, 1531, entitled That a Governor Ought to Be Merciful and the Diversity Between Mercy and Vain Pity. Eliot says, "And if you ask me what mercy is, it's a temperance of the mind of him that hath power to be avenged. And it's called in Latin clementia, and is always joined with reason. For he that on every little occasion is moved with compassion, and beholding a man condignly punished for his offense, lamenteth or waileth, is called piteous, which is a sickness of the mind, and yet it's a sickness much worse by adding to it one word, calling it vain pity." During the first half of Measure for Measure, Shakespeare uses this idea that the ruler ought occasionally to avoid mercy as an unreasonable act. The conflict lies between those who cry out for mercy and those who conscientiously avoid vain pity. The problem of the play initially grows out of the Duke's perception that he has been too willing to forgive. Therefore, any attempt to explain the principle of mercy which underlies the acts of forgiveness in the final act must take this fact into account. If the corruption in Vienna has been due to the Duke's negligence of the law, how can his willingness to forgive at least two convicted felons, a corrupt judge, and an admitted perjurer be anything other than a return to the era of corruptness which marks the beginning of the play? Something must happen to one's estimation of the willingness to forgive. Something must happen to change one's estimation of the willingness to forgive from vain pity to some other standard more defensible from the Renaissance point of view. Robert Graham Hunter says in Shakespeare's Comedies of Forgiveness, along about 1965 and 66, that he agrees with a whole line of critics that see the forgiveness in this play as a totally Christian act, and asserts the principle that Christian love must always be willing to forgive, no matter what the circumstances are. That is, that quite rightly, mercy abrogates justice. Ernest Schanzer counters that opinion in Problem Plays of Shakespeare, one of the more intelligent discussions of the play. He says the play simply ends and is not ended. I disagree with that particular estimation of the ending of the play, and I think I've got the key that explains the very thing that Schanzer missed. He talks about excessive clemency in his discussion of the Duke's decision to leave the city, but somehow or other he doesn't connect it with Luther's idea on vocations. First stated in the Duke's explanation for leaving Vienna, the concept of vain pity is repeated by the judges whom the Duke leaves behind. Although Aeschylus is a major voice for those seeking to save the fornicator Claudius, he says of Angelo's severity, "It is but needful. Mercy is not itself which oft looks so. Pardon is still the nurse of second woe. But yet, poor Claudio, there is no remedy." In turn, Angelo defends himself against the imploring of Claudio's sister, Isabella. To her plea that he shows some mercy, the deputy asserts his intention to avoid vain pity. He says, "I show pity most of all when I show justice, for then I pity them I do not know, which a dismissed offense would aftergo, and do him right, that answering one foul wrong lives not to act another." Therefore, the Duke and his magistrates assert their unwillingness to show mercy, to commit vain pity early in the play. In Act 3, however, after the Duke learns that Angelo has been corrupted by his lust for Isabella, the emphasis shifts away from the rhetorical sparring involved in persuading the magistrate to mercy. It shifts towards intrigue against the power which Angelo holds over Claudio's life. This thematic shift, accompanying a dramatic shift, leads to an attitude toward mercy which justifies the spectacle of forgiveness in the last act, justifies it in spite of the strength of the initial conflict between mercy and vain pity. In his concern with the preventive function of the law, the Duke considers only the alternatives of license or death. It is only when he discovers a third amendment of life that he is able to reconcile his bent to mercy with his legal duty as a governor. In Measure for Measure, amendment of life is tied to the concept of vocations. That is, the concept that one may find for himself a new function or vocation which will renew his efforts to be virtuous. This theme of vocations is worked out in the anti-monasticism associated with the three main characters, and nearly all commentators have noted it there. It's worked out in the Reformation of Pompey the Bald, and no one has noted it there. And in the motif of the Duke's disguise, and no one has noted it there. In all three of these areas of the play, the dramatic action of changing vocations prefigures the amendment of life which ultimately justifies forgiveness. The theme of vocations represents one of the central teachings of Reformation ethics. Martin Luther taught that the temporal vocation of the husband, the magistrate, or even the executioner is as sacred as the ecclesiastical one of the friar or the nun. In the course of vigorous attack on monasticism, Luther developed an ethic which requires the Christian to find his vocation not in the cloister, but in the world. In the Sermon on the Mount, "Can a Soldier Be Saved?" and other treatises, Luther named the various worldly vocations and the responsibilities which a Christian faces as he undertakes any one of them. The development of Luther's concept of vocations is described by Gustav Lindgren on Luther on Vocations, translated in 1957. The Lutheran ethic was subsequently disseminated in the midst of Reformation controversy. I think it reached England directly through Tyndale's translations of Luther's treatises. That's the most likely way to account for its presence in Shakespeare's ideas. Shakespeare made use of the historical concept of vocations on several levels in Measure for Measure. At first, in the main plot, the theme is introduced somewhat conventionally in terms of changing the cloistered vocation for the worldly one. The Duke, Angelo, and Isabella are all three called from a natural reclusiveness and dramatically propelled from seclusion into the little world of Vienna, where people sin and the customary way of dealing with their sin has fallen into disrepute. The characters must discover what to do about sinful man now that forgiveness has been described as vain pity. In the subplot, the theme of vocations is developed in a different sense. There, the change is a comic switch from one worldly vocation to another. This transformation signals an amendment of life which will make forgiveness justifiable. The development of the theme of vocations in these two separate senses underlies the principle of forgiveness which governs the final act of the play. Pompey the Bawd's transformation into Pompey the Executioner's Helper is opposed by a system of values which denies the possibility of an amendment of life which would warrant forgiveness. Lucio the Fantastic is the spokesman for this attitude which opposes the impulse toward change of vocation. His resistance to the amendment of life prefigures Pompey's comic enactment of the conflict. Lucio's argument is that because human nature is susceptible to vice, there can be no hope of improving human conduct. Consequently, he argues, it is tyrannous to punish what is only natural in man. The connection between Lucio and the theme of vocations is apparent during his first appearance in the play, immediately before Pompey speaks. He and his friends are discussing an impending war with Hungary. In the course of their conversation, one of the gentlemen utters a conventional prayer for peace, which he immediately amends by excluding the Hungarians. Lucio humorously berates his friend for violating the Christian's obligation to pray for peace. He accuses the gentleman of temporizing like the sanctimonious pirate who honored all of the Ten Commandments but that which prohibited stealing. The gentleman counters that both he and the pirate are justified in violating any religious rule that interferes with the free exercise of their respective vocations. He says, why, 'twas a commandment to command the captain and all the rest from their functions they put forth to steal. There's not a soldier of us all that in the thanksgiving before meat do relish the petition well that prays for peace. The gentleman's defense seeks to make comic use of the Lutheran emphasis on vocations by extending the category of vocations to include various kinds of unlawful or unchristian pursuits. Because this fallacious argument implies an attack on the concept of worldly vocations, it also contributes to the complexity of thematic development by voicing the resistance to amendment of life ultimately acted out by Pompey. Moreover, it establishes wit as a major device for resisting amendment of life. Pompey appears in five sequences, each representing a degree in his progress toward a change in worldly vocations. Another aspect of Pompey's role, apart from the fact that he changes, is that the reaction of the other characters to him serve to establish a normative moral standard in a play that calls into question traditional modes of moral judgment. There may be confusion on the questions of Claudio's pardon or Isabella's righteousness, but there's no question about the proper reaction to Pompey the Bawd. In spite of all wit, mercy to him would prove itself a bawd. When he first appears in the play, events are already in motion to bring Pompey to the notice of the law. Although he is still free to stand in the street and watch the unfortunate Claudio be hauled off to prison, he can already report that the forces of reformation threaten him. He has news of recent proclamations that condemn the houses of vice in the suburbs, thrusting him and Mistress Overdone out of house and business. Pompey assures his companion that they will find a way to continue in their vocation. He says, come, fear not you. Good counselors lack not clients. Though you change your place, you need not change your trade. This determination to pursue bawdry is reiterated very shortly when he appears next in the play in the court of Aeschylus. Pompey is brought before Aeschylus by the constable Elbo, who lodges a complaint that Pompey has offered indecent insults to the very pregnant Mistress Elbo. Aeschylus is hampered in making the judgment because Pompey will not admit to any wrongdoing, and Elbo is incompetent to testify. Pompey's wit and elaborate pretense of innocence readily frustrates Elbo's angry malapropism. It appears for a while that vice will enjoy a comic triumph through the wit of the bawd. Finally, Aeschylus intervenes and undertakes to deal with Pompey by bringing the unrepentant bawd to a sense of his own guilt. Pompey says, truly, sir, I'm a poor fellow that would live. Aeschylus retorts, "How would you live, Pompey? By being a bard? What do you think of the trade, Pompey? Is it a lawful trade?" When Pompey observes that the law can scarcely prevent it, Aeschylus threatens him with a whipping and lets him go. Pompey answers the judge's stern warning with an impudent aside. "Whip me? No, no, let Carmen whip his jade. The valiant heart's not whipped out of his trade." It's clear that this confrontation with the law has not yet tempered Pompey's resistance to amendment of life. The bard next appears in the street before the prison. This is the first scene of Act III, more or less the turning point of the play, I think. Elbow has finally succeeded in bringing his man to justice. This scene is significant because it represents a confrontation between the bard and the Duke in disguise. When he meets Pompey in the street, the Friar Duke is coming from his first meeting with Isabella. He's just fallen in love with her. He has discreetly overheard her revelation of Angelo's corruption and her subsequent attack on Claudio for begging her to satisfy the deputy's lust to buy a brother's life. On the basis of what he has heard, the Duke has proposed an intrigue designed to frustrate Angelo's intentions and secure a pardon. Full of his plans for the bed trick, he comes up out of the prison to encounter Elbow's party. He erupts into an angry exclamation when he learns the nature of Pompey's offense. He says, "Fie, sirrah, a bawd, a wicked bawd. The evil that thou causest to be done, 'tis thy means to live. Dost thou but think what 'tis to cram a mar, clothe a back, from such a filthy vice? Say to thyself, from their abominable and beastly touches I drink, I eat, array myself, and live. Canst thou believe thy living is a vice so stinkingly depending? Go mend, go mend." The Friar Duke's attack on Pompey exactly parallels Isabel's attack on Claudio in the scene preceding this one. Then the eavesdropping Friar Duke had heard Isabella say to her brother, "Oh, fie, fie, fie. Thy sin's not accidental, but a trade. Mercy to thee would prove itself a bawd. 'Tis best that thou diest quickly." The similarities between Isabel's attack and the Friar Duke's are clear. Both Pompey and Claudio are denounced for trying to procure a woman to satisfy another man's lust. Both have done so, they say, in order to live. Pompey has already called himself a poor fellow that would live. Claudio's cry to Isabella was, "Sweet sister, let me live." The important dissimilarity lies in the conclusions which Isabella and the Duke draw from their recognition of frailty and the brother and the bard. Isabella says, "Mercy to thee would prove itself a bard. 'Tis best that thou diest quickly." Her words are a restatement of the concept of vain pity. The Friar Duke, however, concludes, "Go mend, go mend." In this, he joins his voice with that of Aeschylus in proposing amendment of life as a way of dealing with sin, but he does not experience Aeschylus' difficulty in striking past the bard's wit to convict the miscreant. Pompey is simply not permitted to make his customary witty reply. He is cut off in mid-phrase when the Friar Duke says, "Nay, if the devil hath given thee proofs for sin, thou wilt prove his." Taking the prison officer, correction and instruction must both work ere this rude beast will profit. So the playwright changes the pattern which has characterized the other scenes in which Pompey has appeared. His wit can no longer serve as a tool to resist the impulse to amend his life. Pompey begins to surrender to the forces of change when the provost proposes to make the bawd the executioner's helper. After proper consultation with the executioner, in which he tries to convince that worthy that the bawd's trade, like the executioner's trade, is a mystery, Pompey says that he will become an executioner because it's a more penitent trade. The executioner is always asking forgiveness of those whom they execute. He says, "Sir, I have been an unlawful bawd time out of mind, but yet I will be content to be a lawful hangman. I would be glad to receive some instruction from my fellow partner." Pompey reappears only briefly once more, active in his new trade as executioner's helper, but comically ineffective. He and Ab Horsman are finding it difficult to persuade the reprobate Barnardine to submit to their offices. It is here that Pompey leaves the play, trailing out of the scene behind Ab Horsman. The main function of Pompey's role is to show that there is an alternative course of action, both to letting the purveyors of vice thrive, that's vain pity, and to committing the miscreants to death, and that's tyranny. Pompey exemplifies this alternative in his successful assumption of a new vocation, and thus illuminates the actions of the Duke and the apparently indiscriminate forgiving which takes place in the last act. After first permitting vice to thrive, and then permitting Claudio to face death, the Duke finally finds himself in the position of placing other characters in new vocations. Therefore, the many acts of charity which end the play may be construed as so many changes of vocation and explained in that light.
Sure, you all join me in thanking the presenters of these papers. And now, if there are any questions that you wish to address to either of them, we have some time for discussion.
Yes, this is a very interesting phenomenon altogether. There were a lot of women who wrote poetry, translations especially favored because it allowed a woman to fall back on her original for support. There's an inbuilt inferiority complex almost in so many 16th and 17th century women writers, and they frequently either have their material published for them by somebody else or under an assumed name, or else do translations. And it's not really until the mid-17th century that women writers as such gain the kind of confidence, and there's almost a nascent women's liberation movement going on in 17th century women writers. It's a whole area of very interesting material, I think. Mary Sidney is especially interesting because she works in translation, and when she branches out on her own, without the original to fall back on, much of her writing can be very weak. Her original poetry, which has no particular original in mind, is often very bad. But where she has the confidence, in this case, of the Psalms behind her, she can branch out in all kinds of autonomous directions. Yes, you know, women writers are a very interesting phenomenon altogether in the age.
I'm a little puzzled by Ms. Jones' conclusions about Pompey. Is it not possible that Pompey in those later scenes, I reread the play recently, in those recent scenes toward the end, is simply adopting protective coloration?
Well, there are two things that happen in the scene he's taken to prison to show that Pompey is going to be stripped of his wit and be forced to turn it to other things. He says not to be whipped out of his tray, but caught in the coil of the law, it is brought out of this trade by proper instruction. First there's the Duke's instruction, when he cuts him off and deprives him of any back talk. Now the Duke's not able to do this to Lucio just a moment later in the same scene. He's not able to cut Lucio's wit off, but he does cut Pompey's wit off. And then just after the Duke speaks, Lucio comes on the scene and he says, "Aha, Pompey, I see they've got you now. You'll be a play good husband now, Pompey. You'll keep the house." I would consider those terms almost prophetic because they predict what actually happens. And the fact that the words function, tree, and amendment are used almost precisely seems to reinforce my position that he's in the play primarily to be changed, as the other characters end up being changed too, into good husbands, as Lucio said. To change all those criminals at the end except the reprobate Barnaby in good husbands.
He doesn't lose his wit completely.
He just doesn't. He's just not allowed to use it to. He's just not allowed to use it against the forces of justice again. Now, when he encounters that horseman, Vorson is about to let a boy into the mystery, and he uses his wit then to convince a Vorson that he should let him in. And then he uses his wit as a kind of mode for justifying his amendment of life. Said he finds a more penitent trade. But then he's cut off altogether. He doesn't just speak again in the flesh.
Transformations within individuals certainly is frequent in Shakespeare. I think sometimes this takes place with a change of location, as you suggested, this change from the cloister into the more open world has an enlightening effect on those immediately connected with this. In Hamlet's from the University to the Court, strangely. In Lear from the Court to the Heath, almost as if there's an entire movement. Even in the comedies, in some nice dream from the city to the wooded area around
now
there.
Greenwood play from
Othello from
Othello from Venice, which surprisingly is ordered to
play. Right. But you said when he goes into disguise, he says he shall frequent the court and the town and see what seems to be. But the fact is, we see him two places in the play before the final street scene. He's at Marianne's Moore's Grange, where they more than half go on the set conspiracy of. But he's in prison all the rest of the time. And of course, that takes me to the whole business of how the youth's disguise is a kind of change of location, too. A fascinating discovery I made is that the Duke cannot be a good ruler by being merciful, but he says when he enters the prison that according to his natural inclination and his blessed order, he can quite rightly be a merciful man, and he sets out to be merciful the best way he can. Unfortunately, he finds when it comes right down to executing the miscreant, the criminal has to be in a very penitential mood, and the best he can achieve, even working there in the prison with him, is a remorseful mood. And one where, I mean, both of his reconstruction and rehabilitation attempts break down right in front of the audience. He tries one on Claudio, giving that beautiful Be Absolute for Death speech. He turns his back, Claudio says, "Sweet sister, let me live." And he's got to come back and try to reconstruct the play, I mean, reconstruct the line of action, given Claudio's reluctance to die. Then he goes down to, he's got to have a head in a hurry, and so he figures he might as well have Barnabine, because Barnabine is obvious, friendly. So he goes marching down in the dungeon to grab Barnabine. Barnabine says, "You go to hell, because I'm not going to die today, I'm too drunk." And the Duke, and he says, "Get him out of here, get him out of here." And Barnabine just digs his heel and says, "You're not going to get me to play your funny games." And the Duke says, "It would be damnable to condemn him in this way of mine." And so you find the Duke in an absolutely hilarious position of being unable to execute anybody and unable to forgive anybody. He's damned if he is, and he's damned if he is. And he's got to resolve that somehow, and it seems to me that hitting upon the idea of marrying everybody off is probably the only thing that saved him. Incidentally, the first character that comes up with that idea is, oddly enough, Isabella, because Lucia wrote because your brother's in trouble. She says, "He is. What for?" He says, "For getting girls pregnant." He says, "Well, why don't they get them married?" You know, that's her first reaction when she hears that. He says, "The deputy won't let him do it." And then she comes in. So it is the right-minded answer to the question, and he just has to swirl around a little bit until he can justify what he's trying to do. And vocation, the whole concept of vocation, is a justification for mercy.
Could I take this up?
Yeah.
On the question of method in using intellectual keys to Shakespeare, you've used the idea of vocation and you've applied it to Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And I just want to examine two things. One, the general principles involved in doing this, and two, the particular example. It's a very common kind of technique in approaching Shakespeare, and I say this with feeling because I have done it myself. To use a concept that you are fascinated with or find very interesting in theologians, philosophers, social historians from whatever period, whether it's from Herodotus to Nietzsche and Leon, and say, aha, that is the key to Shakespeare. And you go through with a kind of litmus paper and you dip it into all the plays, and every time it comes up pink. And, you know, because you can always find evidence for an idea being present in a play of Shakespeare. This is a fascinating thing about him. There's one, you know, there are a number of qualifications one wants to make for this. First of all, that these things are plays, and that although Shakespeare may be playing in a sort of homo ludens sense with ideas, it doesn't mean to say he is reinforcing a particular line on any idea. And the second is this, that when you get vague, abstract, general concepts like vocation, or in my case, it was something else, you have often undergone a kind of process of conversion, if you've done this, and you are blinded to the actual context with which you're dealing. Now, when listening to your very interesting exposition of Measure for Measure, I was wondering, now, what other word would fit? And all the time you were giving examples, I was thinking of equally valid concepts that would fit or describe the particular bit of action. And the common way that we bad Shakespeare scholars do this is by saying, this is what Luther, Calvin, Giordano Bruno, whoever says on something or other. And we all understand this. This is what Shakespeare says, and then we paraphrase the action of the play. And somehow there is just not a specific enough connection between part A and part B. You see, the concept of vocation, I get to the specific example, the concept of vocation as you were describing it, it seems to me is an enormously commonplace notion. Why pick out Luther? Perhaps it's part of the argument you didn't bring up, but it seems to me to be able to fit an enormous variety of Renaissance ethical positions that would come from classical, humanist, all other kinds of religious areas. The whole notion of each man having a vocation and this being an enormously valuable part of his life is such a commonplace Renaissance notion. You get it in Thomas Wilson. I mean, you just go through the whole collection of Renaissance commonplace writers and find it there. Why give it a particular theological direction, or in this case, a particular Lutheran direction? To establish this kind of case, I'm saying, you have got to have something more concrete, in other words, than simply paralleling what I think is a very general idea alongside a play. I say this with some force because it's something that I myself tend to do so often. Because where do you stop applying it? Antony, in Antony and Cleopatra, his vocation is that of a warrior, and he's praised right through the first half of the play as being the epitome of martial valor. And in a sense, you could argue that the intellectual structure of the play is about him realizing his real vocation is that of a lover, or his real vocation is that of a wholly committed adulterer. Now, you know, things are getting a bit peculiar when you say, but aha, that's explained by the Lutheran doctrine of vocation. Well, you know, maybe. Luther's attitude to marriage was a very interesting one. But whether it leads down that slippery slope to Antony and Cleopatra is another matter. And you could instance example after example. Where do you stop when you apply this kind of thing? So, you know, this, if I throw this into the melting pot, there's a general question of method and also the specific thing. I'm very interested in how you tie it down to the Lutheran.
Okay, I didn't brought that up because I had prepared 3 years for that chicken battle in my dissertation. Exactly the same way. First, the Lutheran nature of here. Although I don't deal with the play of Henry the Fourth Part One in my study of Falstaff, that's not his vocation. And there's a primary religious term. I'm sorry. Falstaff talks about vocation in Henry IV, Part 1, and in a deliberately religious sense, and he uses the names of sects, religious sects, in order to identify his Luddite tendency. Luddite tendencies are not Lutheran tendencies, so I won't try to say that. What I can say is that Shakespeare was aware of the significantly religious nature of the question. Second, he introduces it into the play with the animisticism, which I think can be tied to the primarily religious emphasis of a minimum of life and vocation as an idea. I chose Luther primarily because in his major treatises, as Lindgren very carefully points out, Luther deals with the question quite specifically on religious terms. And Luther's treatises were then, and including the one Canon Sobrio be saved, where he deals with it most specifically, Luther's treatises were translated by Tyndale. Tyndale traces down which particular treatises were translated by Tyndale. Tyndale gives him a nice covenant twist as he translates them, but they come into the English language that way. Shakespeare seems to have been aware of the idea with its religious connotations, and he seems to have been interested in it primarily as a way of dealing with social problems rather than religious problems. Now, why he ties both religious and social ideas together, I don't know, unless he was accustomed to think of social problems in religious terms. I think the question of where it is to stop on vocations in Shakespeare, I didn't take it past Measure for Measure. I haven't been tempted to take it past Measure for Measure. Because the word man, the word trade, the word function, just doesn't come up in Antony and Cleopatra either.
Oh, come. I mean, the whole notion of Cleopatra as a queen goddess whore is implied there.
Yes, but it's not talked of as a trade or a vocation. It's talked of as a sort of lifestyle, I think, which is a...
Well, how do you know it's not Calvin that Luther...
Because I read a lot of Calvin. And Calvin...
Calvin has a doctrine of
vocation. Yeah, Calvin tends to agree with Lucio about the state of human nature, but he wouldn't conclude from that man ought to be relieved from the demands of justice. He'd conclude, let the poor devil go to hell, since that's good enough for him. Luther comes at it from the central idea in Luther's social ethic is forgiveness as a way of... In one place, I remember Luther says it's better to forgive a bad man than the high man. He said this in temporal order, I think.
I'm also struck by Calvin's handling of some of the prostitutes in Geneva, where he helped to have kind of textual factors established where women were put in there for constructive work rather than throwing them in the or just going out to sit here and ride well like a wooden monkey. So there was a construction element.
I did not know I had Calvin's pillow, you know, to bring the body into the prison.
This strikes me as being the kind of thing about the slippery slope. You're setting out Shakespeare as a man who worked with Luther there, and all now Calvin.
No.
I'm sure the cast of mind portrayed in the Shakespearean plays is a man, of course he's aware of religious ideas and is fascinated with them, but he's not saying, aha, now I must deal with the Lutheran doctrine of vocation, and this is a good example of this kind of thing. He's penetrating to the experiential roots of this kind of thing.
And the experiential roots lie in a great deal of religious controversy that happened to go on when men couldn't be sure who would not, might not be burned the next week if the government were at fault.
But it constantly amazes me that you go back to Lutheran because the Lutheran position was pretty well washed out by 50 and 60. And by the time Shakespeare comes along, you've got a pretty strong Anglican view being expressed theologically.
The Anglican movement has been shaped by envoys from German Lutheranism who came directly
into the court. Well, that's debated pretty strongly. Was there very much
influence from
Dalton in 1560 and then later on when...
I think it was 1603, why not pick out William Perkins, who's the most widely read and important English theologian?
As
a vocation.
As Ernest Chandler does, then he chooses to talk about excessive clemency instead. Perkins I would just love it if Shakespeare would use the term being pity and all kinds of stuff. But I couldn't get him to do it. I tried it which way, and I looked in every concordance I could find, and I couldn't make him do it. So then I tried out some of the terms that Chandler comes up with, excessive clemency, that's the one I think of right now, and it comes out of Perkins. He didn't use that one either. He just has a man say, pity would make a lot of pity to show mercy to you, and it states a concept pretty clearly. I think of anything to use for Thomas Elliot. Now, why haven't you hit me on Elliot? Now, I pointed specifically at Elliot as a source, you know. I could have used Perkins or Elliot or Joseph Hall, who comes a little later, but has a lovely character of the magistrate, in which the magistrate is the man who can tell the difference between pity and charity. Yeah?
Let me react a little bit to what you're saying. I think I agree with Professor Waller about this problem of saying this source or this source. I guess partly because I'm more of a formalist training. And it seems to me that I would react in defense of your paper in saying that no matter whether it's Lutheran or what, I do think that you're really on to something very important by focusing on the notion of okay.
Well, certainly the theme explains something that has not been explicable by any other way except calling it a cop-out.
Yeah.
It's either, Chandler says Shakespeare cops out, you see, and just contrives an end to an impossible play. That's almost Chandler's work. Robert Graham Hunter says, you know, that the Christian cops out, that he doesn't have any justice in this world, that he must forgive and forgive and forgive and forgive. And he has lots of company in taking that position, because I think Wilson Knight takes it, and the whole R.K. Chambers, who loves Isabella, takes it. They all fall in love with the idea of forgiveness and say that mercy absolutely aggregates justice, and it just seems so, not in the context of the play.
I just wish Shakespeare put a little more emphasis on it toward the end, if that is what he meant. Yeah. I mean, the fact that it's taken us 350 years to find it.
I know, and I understand strange, you know, that jewels should show up in my casket.
Let me ask you, pursuing the question of vocation, following you to a certain extent on the notion, and I like it because it explains some things that sometimes puzzle me, like the sanctimonious pirate, gives it a real function.
No, that's when I thought the business about the trade and what is it, function, the word function is. The last time I had heard that, I just said kind of soldier be saved. I've been reading.
Yeah, well, picking up from the soldier be saved for me, so that it bothers me that Pompey's new vocation is that of penguin, that it's such an odd vocation if he's going to take one that's so redemptive.
It's exactly the same. It's exactly the kind. Well, for one thing, it's comic. One thing, it's dramatically available, you know. But it's exactly the kind of thing that Luther deals with so much in his social commentary. And they keep saying, should a Christian have to sit on the bench? Should a Christian have to be the magistrate? Should a Christian have to kill for a prince? And Luther said, yes. A Christian not only can do these things, but must, in a world that is not Christ, he must do these things.
Yeah, again,
it's his vocation.
You're moving farther out of the play than I'm willing to go right away. What I really want to do in the play
is
we going to take that seriously, or is that perhaps a parody on the main theme where we would take vocation seriously? In fact, he's such a bad Hamlet, for example. He doesn't really execute that vocation.
Well, he wasn't very successful as a bard either.
Well, he must have been. Surely the trade was flourishing in, you know.
Poor old Pompey is doomed by the very nature of his role to be an unsuccessful human being, but he's better being an unsuccessful execution stuffer than he is being an unsuccessful god. I mean, everybody agrees that he is. I can beg questions just about the world's next one.
How do you fit Angelo, the granting of mercy to Angelo? What is his name located?
I'm puzzled by two things in that last spectacle. You have to remember, it's just as much a spectacle as what Prospero arranges. And that seems to be an important key to the whole tone of the last act of the play. Why did he lie to Isabella and tell her Bill is dead? In order to cause some kind of transformation, he said, on her heart. Then why does he not confront Angela and say, I know that you are damn adulterer and that you are talking about part of the law? Why did he go through the charade of coming on stage, leaving the stage, putting on the habit, coming back on stage, and finally having the habit to remove? Why? And one answer to that question is the Duke is a paper Duke, and that's just what she has to do. To play the scene and make good theater. And it does make good theater. It's very, very affecting to see Isabella fall to her knees as I marry Adam. Don't consider my brother's case, don't consider the part. I didn't even consider me not to my brother's case at all. He wanted to manipulate people into a repentant mood. That's why he placed the role of the friar in the first place. The only time he seems to succeed is when he takes up his friar's robes and they know that he knows everything there is to know and he's got all the power there is to have. And he chooses to exercise and seems to force people into all sorts of very dramatic, very stirring kind of actions, which are exactly what the audience wants to do. Because we don't want Marianna, the motive branch, weeping over Angela's grave.
And I say it's a medium triple spiritual power, too.
All I know is that he caused to happen what we wanted to happen, but then he caused us to want it to happen.
Well, isn't that surely of theological as well as emotional significance?
Sure.
You know, the end of the play seems to me to be a far more profound statement of theology and its effect on the audience than you know any abstract notion that's gone on in the body or may not have gone on in the body of the play. That's one of the great moments of Shakespeare, and it's great not simply because it's theatrically effective, but because it's enormously profound as a human truth, and regardless of motivation or by naturalistic criteria. There it is. It's something that we, the audience, can enter into, and which gets in many ways to the heart of part of the human mystery.
Well, how do you explain the fact that so many people have been outraged by the ending of that play?
Oh, because they've come to it with preconceived notions of what justice is, just as, in a sense, we all do. The play there deliberately sets up what we see as just, and the Duke asks Isabella, in effect, to judge Angelo. And sets her up is that the primary test case is she going to judge him by all the laws of nature, allegiance, the state. She should judge, nor is she going to bring in this extra criteria, which you know, quite rightly point out. And there's a terrible pause, which is, as I say, the theological as well as theatrical weight, and she chooses to forgive him in a very profound and human way. And I think that's one of the most, both, as I say, moving and theologically profound moments in Shakespeare.
I think one of the most essential facts of the play is the Duke's reluctance to come out of his disguise. Because Shakespeare brings in several moments when the audience just knows that now he's got to talk. And that confrontation with Lucio, besides being absolutely hilarious, it happens to be absolutely serious, too. Because here's where the play goes one way or the other. Surely he will not tolerate this. And then when he finds himself, Barnaby won't admit to death, and then he finds that he can't execute Barnaby, and I say, my
why does the Throbbing Rose and why am I going, Will? It's all I have to do is here's my ring and we'll storm the palace and hang Claudio. I mean, Norman Holland has shown that in the found story of Machiavelli, and in Machiavelli, Duke Murray comes back, chops Dickens' head off, he's doing it over. He does it on purpose. He knows that effectiveness of the lure has been damaged. He puts somebody in his place, it goes off, less effectiveness of the lure reestablished, comes back, chops Guy's head off, and we're all set.
Yeah, a process that, that Thomas Elliot would approve of, probably. Because
oh, yes. The point is the forgiveness at the end of the play, is mine not married with heart and then forgiveness? Because there is amendment of law in that forgiveness. Thomas Elliot would have to say that forgiveness in the landscape is not vain pity because the mind is married with the heart, and the fellow who has charge of it is he who has power to be avenged. We have to be careful using these outside sources because we might read too much into the plot if you rely too much. Always, in history of ideas, the problem is how can you rock, push, and bring them together. The literary thing and the philosophical or religious or whatever thing. One reason that I didn't fall back on vocations of the commonplace, which would have been equally grateful problem, was the fact that it is stated so explicitly in Luther that at least I have one authoritative source about what is supposed to constitute a vocation, what is expected from a vocation, how it operates, what exactly how this the fallacy is used against the whole argument of vocations. This business of extending the category past unchristian pursuits in order to attack Luther. I saw that then in some anytime I have a student bring me a paper that I want to put a theological idea with the Shakespeare, I say, all right, you find a source for that theological idea so you can nail it down. But always you run the risk of appearing to say Luther influenced Shakespeare. And what I'm actually saying is this idea is current in the period, and Shakespeare made explicit in lecture and dramatic use of it. And if I want to know about the idea, probably a good sound source on it is it happens to be Martin Luther, because he dealt with it explicitly. And a good source on Luther is Wingren, and so I can go great. I guess what I should have said is that Wingren says this about vocations and we can operate on Shakespeare.
I'd like
yes.
to ask Professor Waller a question about the sources that the Constant Pembroke used. He said that she did some translating. Do you know if she was able to use Hebrew or did she use the Septuagint?
It's pretty clear that she couldn't read Hebrew. Not only from the sources of that we have of her education, but also by the general assumption about aristocratic ladies' education at the time. The sources that the Sydneys used are fairly easily definable, or have been by a number of people. They gave intellectual precedence, usually, as I say, to the Geneva version, probably because they had intellectual leanings towards the Calvinist direction anyway. They, by certain echoes in their Psalms, they obviously consulted at least half a dozen well-known commentaries, which would either have been in English version or in Latin or continental vernacular. Technically, they seem to use the Maro Beza Psalter, which Calvin, of course, introduced, and Buchanan's Latin paraphrases, which possibly gave them the idea for the metrical variety. There are a whole, I mean, as everybody knows, there's a whole host of continental psalm metaphrases that are going on, and some of these, I should think, would be generally in their mind as a background. Now, it's very difficult when you're working with a large number of versions that have very similarly worded translations to pin down a source. It's a matter of discriminating at points where they do definitely seem to be following somebody against a whole examples where any or no commentators or versions could be sources. This is debatable.
Because if she did, maybe the Septuagint was the source.
A number of people have suggested this to be the case. The evidence they've put up seems to me to be convincing until you start looking at other sources, and she could have equally got it from them, so it's an open question. Quite probably she did read Greek. Again, the educational background she would have had would have suggested she might well have, and certainly Sydney seems to have. So, yeah, I mean, yes would be the cautious answer there. But there seem to be a certain limited number that they are following rather than others, although I think they're probably generally aware of a large variety.
We have about 1 minute. Can I try a very large question in 1 minute of you? Why do you think until the end of the 16th century there was so little religious poetry other than metrical songs? How do you account for that?
Can I deal with Protestantism first? Partly because of theological reasons involved in the distrust of the human mind and the human imagination and the word, the human word as opposed to the divine word for mediating truth. You get it the rise from by the middle of the 16th century onwards of what has been called the divine poetry movement, and it gets to England late. And it is very much involved with finding a justification for the poet exercising his imagination independent of the Bible. And it would be natural for a Protestant poet to stay as close as possible to the, as it were, divinely approved means of expressing religious experience. And to me, it's almost an unconscious kind of development at the end of the 16th century. It's been said, I think rightly, that the best poetical theory in the 16th and 17th centuries is in the poetry, not in the theories. And this seems to me to be what's happening then, that Protestant poets, among whom the Countess and his circle in England are the best known, are discovering a kind of autonomy in the actual act of writing poetry rather than theorizing about it. And the stranglehold that the Protestant distrust of the word, small w, as opposed to the word, capital W, has been operating until then, gradually loosens. As far as Catholics are concerned, I think an analogous process operates. The Counter-Reformation had cultural effects that were very similar in many ways to that of the Reformation. And I wouldn't like to generalize this, because it seems to me to vary from one country to another, but certainly in both Italian and Spanish poetic traditions, a very similar presence of wrestling with this problem of the divine inspiration and the human word comes in. In fact, makes the subject of the best poetry. How do you get into poetical words that overwhelming, inspiring revelation comes to the individual soul? Because in this whole Protestant and Catholic movement, it's very much a matter of the individual soul and the individual poem.
Well, we're out of time. I wish to thank both the participants and those of you who came. Very much.